Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 27th of April. It's 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and a great pleasure to have you with us, as it always is. If you're new to the program, if you haven't listened before, or if you're just started listening to the show, here's what we do on the show. We have 180 minutes to kill. And, what we do, provide you with high-quality entertainment. That's right. And so we have 180 minutes, and we make it up, and we do a lot of neat things. And we talk to people, and we have a wonderful panel. And the panel is made up of great experts from all sorts of backgrounds, and they talk about the issues of the day. And we welcome you to join in and share your thoughts as well of what you think is going on in the world. And if you think they're on the right track, or maybe you have another viewpoint, we'd love to hear from you. It's as simple as that. Then we'll talk to some other folks down the line. It's all great. And in the end, we sing and we're happy, and then we go to Midday Magazine and we get depressed of what's happening in the world. So that's basically how we roll. Good morning, welcome, and it's a pleasure to have you all here. Let me introduce everyone. A reminder, if you'd like to be a part of the program, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. It's you can start to call me Killer Chartok.
Oh, Killer.
See, time killer Chartok.
Oh, time killer. Yeah. My brother uses that expression. I'll say, hey, Pat, and he'll say, hey, Killer. And so I could sort of use that to you. That'd be good.
Sure.
Good. Good morning, Cohoes City Director of Operations Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa. A pleasure to hear your voice.
Good morning, and delightful to be here. I hope all is going well with everyone in our listening areas.
Well, it's great to have you here. Thank you very much. Let's see. We also welcome investigative journalist, UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Getting ready for a May Day party this weekend.
Oh, that's great. Excellent. That sounds fun. No? Yeah? It sounds fun.
I hope so. I hope so, yes. It's in Maypole and a whiskey sour fountain. My next door neighbor said, did I read that you're having pole dancing and whiskey sour? I'll be there. I said, no, you read that wrong.
Maypole. You're dancing around the Maypole. It isn't pole dancing. Yeah. Right. There's a difference.
Not the same as pole dancing.
No. Although I bet more people would show up. Well, whatever. We welcome you to the proceedings. An old friend of ours is back. He's here, and we couldn't be more thrilled. When he's in town, he joins us, and when he's not in town, he's in Cairo. But Bard Center for Civic Engagement Senior Fellow and Dean of the School of Continuing Education at the American University at Cairo, Jim Ketterer is here. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. It's nice to be back. And as always, very hard to follow Rosemary. I just can't top that already.
Now, just have a party. Tell people about it.
Yes.
Now, are you...
Is everyone invited?
That's right. So are you...
Yes, you are. You guys are. Not the whole listening. No, I think that would violate...
Yeah, we have to... I think that CDC guidelines to get here, too.
The last time I did this, I put it on Facebook and said, oh, everybody's welcome. And then my sister, who is doing the logistics, said, well, how many people are coming? I said, I don't know. I put it out on Facebook. And she says, well, how many friends do you have? And at the time, it was just under 2,000. So she kind of went crazy. And she's forbidden me to do that this
year.
Yeah,
I can understand that.
Well, how many people showed up, Rosemary?
It was about 60 last year. We're aiming for 100 this time.
Oh, that's good.
That's underneath, you can have graduation parties and weddings that are that big, and it's all outside. We did all COVID food, in individual packets. People wear masks, and most of them are vaccinated, so we think it'll be okay.
Excellent. We hope. Now, Jim, back to you for a second. You were here for a while after the original shutdown. Then you went back to Cairo, and now you're back. So, do we have you for a while, or are you headed back soon?
For a little while, and then I'm headed back. Things are very difficult in Egypt right now with COVID. I know there's a lot of attention on India, and rightly so, and other places, and we may talk about that later. But I'm here for a little while, but I probably will head back at the beginning of June or so.
All right. Well, We'll book you every day from now until then. We're thrilled that you're here. Thank you very much. It's always always wonderful to have you on our program and have you share your perspective with our listeners. All right, let's get going. I started last night. I was so just so people know, I don't know why I'm in an introductory mood today, telling people like what we do here. We've been doing it for 20 years, but here's basically what we do. So we have our panel, and then I will go the night before and sort of go over and just put what I refer to as the docket of stories. And by no means do we ever stick to even 10% of it, but we put some stories together, and just so we're all on the same page and give people an idea of what we're going to talk about. And I usually try for five. And I think, oh, okay, I'll go for five stories and see what we can find. And you try to get varied things, and you try to talk about things that you know that our panel is up on and all that stuff. And last night, I think I came up with 12 stories. So we have a lot to get to. And if we get to three, I'll be happy. But I was curious as to how much there was in the news. And it's some really interesting things. So here we go. I want to begin, of course, with the census. The census is a huge deal. It shows U.S. population grew at the slowest pace since the 1930s. Population growth slowed, according to data released on Monday by the U.S. Census Bureau. The first numbers to come out of the 2020 census show the U.S. population on April 1st, 2020, Census Day, was 331.5 million people, an increase of just 7.4% between 2010 and 2020. It is the second slowest rate of expansion since the government began taking a census in 1790. In the 1930s, the decade with the slowest population growth, the rate was 7.3%. Unlike the slowdown of the Great Depression, which was a blip followed by a boom, the slowdown this time is part of a longer-term trend tied to the aging of the country's white population, decreased fertility rates, and lagging immigration. Obviously, Alan, I want to get into in a few moments, we'll talk about what this means for congressional seats. But when we talk about the numbers themselves, what do you make of the population trends?
Well, we had a president, Donald Trump, who made it clear he didn't want anybody coming into the country. And on reflection, it makes sense in that the fewer people come in, the fewer the rate of Democratic increase. Obviously, these are folks who eventually are going to vote Democratic or who will influence the vote Democratic. So he wanted to keep everybody out, and he tried his best in order to do that. And now we have this aging population. And people over 80, and which is not unusual anymore. It used to be very unusual. So we have a new demographic, right, of important people.
We're living longer, which is good news.
Well, yeah, it, for some people. And it is. But I wanted to go to Rosemary because I wanted to go to Rosemary because, as you know, Rosemary was a census taker.
She was out in the field.
That's right. And she had a pretty good idea of who was answering the door and, more importantly, who was not. I think I read in one of the articles that we were looking at, that I was looking at today, because I get up at 2 and I read the Washington Post cover to cover in the Times. I think I was reading, and maybe I got this wrong, that 89 people would have changed where we were in the great census race of how many people we needed in order to maintain the one congressman that we lost.
89, in New York State.
That's, yeah, right. 89 people determined the whole deal. Now, we all know that a lot of people were not opening their doors either because of, you know, their citizenship status or because they were afraid of the ICE, and the ICE man cometh. And that's why it is so. I mean, don't tell me there weren't 89 people who didn't come and answer the census, because we know they were. Rosemary, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I've been talking to several of my friends who also did enumeration, and mostly what we're feeling is guilt. I calculated that I got answers from maybe 15 to 20 people every shift I went out. So I alone, if I worked five extra days, might have made the difference to New York's representation. So we all feel that same way, like, oh, my God, so close. On the other hand, as I said on Facebook today, if it means Elise Stefanik or Lee Zeldin loses their seat, I don't care so much. So that's just a little snarky aside. The other point I would make is that we enumerators have little faith in the accuracy of information we were getting towards the end, especially towards the end. The census, as you remember, started very late because of COVID, which is another reason people didn't come to their door, by the way. They just didn't want to see strangers outside and talk with them, intermingle with them for 15 minutes that it took to answer the census. So it was very late. It was really snookered by the Trump administration, which didn't want immigrants counted, didn't want the didn't want extra time for accurate counting and time to get out and reach people. And I was seriously hoping that the Biden administration would just find a way to do like a do-over. But I hear from statisticians that, you know, this one is no more inaccurate than any of the other ones. And still, when you read the numbers, like 89 people in New York, and it wasn't that far off in other states as well, just a few hundred differences in population makes for huge differences over the next 10 years in Congress. So I feel bad about it, mostly bad about it.
Teresa Bourgeois, I have your voice reverberating in my mind because 3 years ago you were concerned about the census and what was happening with it. And so now through all that time, we have taken the census and now we have the report. So I'm interested in your reaction to it. This has been an issue you've been on top of since before it even began.
Right. I too feel a tremendous sense of guilt because I have been concerned about the census for a couple of years, but when I took the job with working for the city of Cahoes, one of my tasks was leading the effort to get people to respond to the census. And when I saw that 89 number again, like Rosemary, I thought, if only I had figured out how to enroll just a few more people, you know, 62 counties, if just one more person per county and 22 more people. And it's yet to be determined if this census will have an asterisk on it in terms of whether or not the count was done right. But we do know that just like there are voter suppression efforts, the Trump administration had what appeared to be a fairly aggressive effort to depress the count and made it very difficult to do that. And layered on that, of course, was the pandemic. And as Rosemary notes, the enumerators didn't actually go out door to door for a while. But for many months before that, people like me and cities and counties all over the state and country were trying to figure out creative ways to get people to sign up on their own. But the long-term implications of this, of New York State losing a House seat, of the undercount, of the count not, perhaps not being accurate, not reflecting the diversity of the population and such, is pretty extensive. And the short-term effects also, I mean, the question is there needs to be reapportionment, but do the states have enough time to do that? And once they do that, the counties and localities have a lot of tasks that they have to do to get the vote right. So what if to get the voting process right? So what implications is this going to have for the 22 elections, which could easily affect the House and Senate? And then what are the long-term implications if we change the House and Senate? This is really has a profound effect on our democracy.
Jim, I promise you we can have more time on the other side of the break, but we just have about a minute. And so your response, and then we can come back to you on the other side.
Sure. I think that, I think if there's any surprise here, maybe the surprise is really that New York didn't lose more. Many people were predicting that the population shift would be more, that Texas would get even more than they did, that Florida would get more, and that New York would lose more. And so to lose only one seat, to lose only what we did, is an interesting thing to look at, whether it's going to be an asterisk or something else. I mean, the way that people will slice and dice these statistics now over the next several years is going to be really interesting to see what's behind these numbers.
And that is, yeah, that is a key question of what's behind the numbers. And of course, we all know that this data sort of drips and drabs over the years as to what we learn from it. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we will talk more about this. We have letters as well. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this short break. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Jim Ketterer on our program this morning on the panel, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Jim writes, my wife and I moved from Kentucky to New York last June. Being good citizens before we left or knew we were leaving, we completed the census in Kentucky. After we moved to New York, a census canvasser came to our door, and I explained that we had already completed the census where we lived. He marked that down and moved on. Should I feel guilty about New York's loss of a congressional seat? I don't think Jim should feel
guilty. I wrote him back already, and I said, maybe.
Okay, that's meaner than I would have been. But I mean, right? He had already completed the form in the state that he lived in at the time.
He was honest. Yeah. He was honest. Yeah. He told the truth. Yeah.
You're supposed to be counted where you lived on April 1st.
Yeah, well, there you go. So let me ask you this question, and Rosemary or Teresa can answer this. One of the things I thought was interesting is that I got the original packet in the mail, and I sent it. And then they, about, I don't know, 3 weeks later, I got another one in the mail saying, you haven't completed your census. Will you please send it? And I was like, oh, did they not get my first one? So I completed it again, and I sent it back. And then they sent me a third one. Now, was that normal?
You're on your way to jail.
I got, when I was out enumerating, I got dozens of comments like the one you just made. Either I'd already filled them out, or I called, or I did this already. I'm sure I did this. And it's the government. So I have no illusion that they're so great at bureaucratic procedures that mistakes were not made, especially in this year when the census was rushed and compressed and it was more online than it's ever been before. And yes, I think the accuracy, as I say, of the census is very much in question in my mind, although I can't find experts who agree with that. So I don't know what to tell you.
But so, can I just jump in?
Sure. Jim and then Teresa, go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I do think that even if there's an asterisk on this one and if the accuracy is in question somewhat, we shouldn't lose sight of really what an extraordinary feat this is that the country goes through every 10 years. And we only need to look at other places around the world where either they don't do it because they don't have the wherewithal to do it, or they do it and they don't release the results because they're so politically sensitive. And this is an extraordinary feat, and that the country does it, and it's at least accurate enough, and that we use those and move on every 10 years. I think it bears celebrating in some way.
America, where we're accurate enough. That's right.
Yeah, it's enough. And, you know, really, in other places, it's a missing piece of the puzzle, and it's hard to run a government properly without a census.
Teresa.
I just came from North Macedonia. I'm sorry, I just want to throw this in because Jim makes a good point. I just came from North Macedonia where they're holding the first census in like forever. And they're extremely worried about it. It's been delayed because they're afraid there's too many Albanians there, which would require under their constitution more representation for Albanians, which they don't like. And Bosnia hasn't had an accurate census in decades because it would show ethnic cleansing. And it would show it in a dramatic statistical form. So you make a really good point. On the other hand, there's no reason at all for questionnaires and for sending people door to door at an immense cost when we have data, the government already collects data that would probably show the information more accurately. That brings up problems of privacy invasion, and Republicans don't want that accurate in the count anyway. So it's really, census is a mess politically.
Teresa.
I was just going to address the process question, which is that when we were working on it, we asked the census folks that because the whole question of getting the forms, you know, 10 different ways,
They
said better to make sure that you have done it because they have a process to scrub for those names for duplicates. And so they did encourage us to do that. But I do agree with Jim. The process, I mean, pre-pandemic, we had put together a pretty fulsome outreach effort with a community that was going to involve a lot of community engagement, and there seemed to be, you know, some enthusiasm for the process, right? We had a lot of fun things we were going to try to do, and it is a, you know, every decade, you know, common thing that people do, but I, you know, there was a lot of hesitancy created around this one, then layered with the pandemic made it extremely difficult, but...
And you know, we have to look at what's happening in the states that gained. So, for example, Texas has gained. And yet, if you look carefully, you'll find that Texas has, you know, interesting changes afoot. And where are the numbers going up in Texas? In Austin. Now, that's a Democratic area.
Right.
So we have to look at that. And as far as, you know, the whole question of the Babe Ruthian type annotation next to the census, or Mickey Mantle or whoever, Roger Maris, whoever it was, there is a real question to me as to whether we need to look at the way in which these changes are occurring and where they're occurring.
You mentioned Texas. Under this information, Texas would gain 2 congressional seats. Colorado, Oregon, Montana, Florida, and North Carolina would gain 1 seat. In the loss column, California, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New York each losing 1 seat, West Virginia as well. What should we make of that information, Alan? Let's talk specifically about the loss of seats.
Well, it's not good because, you know, you get resources based on how many people you have. So if you've lost people, you've lost federal and state resources, or basically federal resources. And not only that, you know, when you get if the state, for example, is looking at something as the deduction of state and local taxes, and you have 1 fewer congressman, that's 1 fewer person to make the argument for you.
So who can... Go ahead, Teresa.
I mean, it definitely, just visibly, you look at that map and you see the shift toward Republican states. You know, it's a pretty significant shift in power toward Republican states, and with the Republican governors doing the reapportionment, and that will have a decade-long effect on policymaking.
So, you know, it's when I look at the map, it's really interesting to me how small the changes were overall. We mentioned that New York only lost 1, we were expecting more. Texas only got 2 when they were expecting 3. Some of that might be Republican resistance. Trump threw up so much shade on the census that many Republicans refused to participate in the census. I think Alabama is grossly undercounted, and they should have had an addition, and they did not. The South did not gain as much as they should. I think it was from, or it could be at least. We don't know. It's just so inaccurate. I don't know where the mistakes come down on. But there is undercounting in the South, I would think, and perhaps even in Texas.
I want to get to a specific question about New York. But before we do, there is a question that is asked within the confines of the article in the New York Times on this, where it asks, will more power shift to Republicans? In response, they write, Republicans control the map-making process in key states like Florida, North Carolina, and Texas, where there are new House seats to be created amid booming suburban populations. The GOP is also likely to eliminate a Democratic district in Ohio, which will lose 1 seat. At the same time, Democratic lawmakers in Illinois and New York are poised to eliminate Republican seats as they draw new maps. And several key states with changes coming to their maps, California, Colorado, Michigan, and Montana, have independent commissions tasked with determining new legislative boundaries on a nonpartisan or bipartisan basis. What should we make of that? Does that answer that question?
You mean if there'll be a shift to Republicans?
Correct.
Well, I think there was going to be a shift to Republicans anyway, but, you know, you look at the map and yes, there will be. The question is how significant. But the other question is how is this going to get done on time? You know, what's the, there's a real process question here because the delay in getting the numbers out, there's a real timetable issue. And is New York State with only 89, to, you know, is New York State going to contest that 89 number? And then that will that delay it even further? And I don't know I'd be interested in hearing from, if anybody listening who's an expert in this, how would that work? I'm not sure how that works if there's a delay.
You mentioned this earlier, Rosemary, and for anyone who wants to respond to this, please do. But you said, okay, well, if Lee Zeldin or Lee Stefanik lose a seat, then, you know, maybe it was worth it. How do we know, and when do we know, and how's that decision made as to who loses a seat?
Well, it's up to a commission in New York. Alan, you must know about that.
Yeah, that's right.
And
that's
New
right.
York is in better. Yeah, New York is in better shape than many states that are Republican controlled totally at the top, and they have Republican committees that will make decisions. And so, of course, they will squeeze the Democrats and make sure the Republicans are safer.
So when will we know?
And New York, of course, has the so-called, you know, nonpartisan commission. But
right.
think about it for a second. New York is a heavily Democratic state. So what's the difference? In other words, they've got to divide. They've got to divide up these districts, but they're going to do it based on population. And since there are so many Democrats, New York doesn't have a lot to worry about. Some of these other states do, and they will. They will be very partisan in the way they do it.
So, Joe,
yeah, you know, I'm always amused that when people don't like the way the lines are drawn, they call it gerrymandering. And when they're okay with it, they call it redistricting. and of course, both parties do this. They do it in an increasingly sophisticated way with all kinds of data that goes into the machines that make this work. You know, it's a heavily partisan process. And so when they talk about bipartisan or nonpartisan commissions, you know, you really have to look at who appoints the people to those commissions. How is the ultimate thing decided? I mean, in New York, it still has to be an up or down vote of the legislature, even though there's a commission working on it, and look at how those people get onto those commissions. So, you know, the partisanship is hot and heavy in this, and I think it's very hard to squeeze it out.
Teresa?
You asked about timing, Joe. There was a February article in the New York Times that raised this concern about timing, because typically the states have the data by March 31st. That's the due date, so that they can then do a reapportionment. And this year that has been pushed back till November, I believe it is. I'm sorry, September. And so it gives far less time for the process to work, and so that people fear there'll be far less transparency as the states compress the reapportionment effort. I don't know if that date's still holding, but back in February, I was reading an article because I was shocked by that the data wouldn't be available till the fall, which I don't know how they managed to do that.
A couple quick letters, and then go ahead.
I was just going to say that's absolutely what they're still saying, that there won't be block data until, which is what basically you need for reapportionment, not until September. And it had to do with the way things were rushed and pushed through, and then there was a halt on it, and now they're calculating it. So, yeah, this is not going to happen for another half a year yet.
All right, I've changed my mind. Let's take a break first, then we'll come back. And I didn't change my mind. I just got a glare from Mike. So I'm going to – we'll take a break. And then when we come back, we'll go to letters and we'll be set. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. I just want you to know when Mike glares at me, it's with a smile. So just that's important to know, at least usually, right? Yeah. Okay. Here we go. We have some letters. We go to this one from Garrett. Actually, I wanted to start with this one from Jim. So let me get this straight, says Jim. A loss of a seat by 89 votes. Why not a recount? Why not investigating the process for fraud? I mean, Trump loses states by thousands of votes. And I'm sure that process was more closely scrutinized. But that process can't be trusted. But the census should be viewed as gospel-type truth? Teresa?
Well, I do know that there is a process. What I don't know is what that process is. But I do know that it has been contested in the past. And there is a process to contest it. And there has been some commentary that I read last night and this morning that said people will look to see if New York will be contesting it, given how close the numbers are.
Robert Wright. Go ahead, Jim.
If I just can say that I think that you open the door to one state, you can start contesting many. I think Michigan held on to a seat by 26 votes.
Right.
So should somebody contest that too and say, well, you don't really deserve that seat. It's only 26 votes. Is that really accurate? And, you know, Teresa was talking about delaying this process. I mean, this could really be, I think, very problematic for the country if this gets delayed and delayed. I would be curious to hear about what the process is, but I certainly hope it's a timely one.
Yeah, I can't imagine it would be. And because there's so many questions about how the census was done last year, you know, I don't know how you would even do that. How do you contest it?
And how does it get to be any more accurate than it is now? Meaning,
exactly. How do you get to a better, when you know the process is flawed, how do you get to a better result?
All right, let's go to some more letters from our listeners. And again, we welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. Robert writes, is there any data if the increases included non-citizens, which Republicans did not want to count? Do we know how that ended up?
I could never figure out how you would know that, because there's no question on the census form about citizenship.
Trump wanted it.
Trump was denied that. So it would require some work by census people using additional databases, which is why I actually think the more confused and upsetting the process is this time, the more we'll be pushing to using data-heavy methods of calculation instead of sending people out door-to-door. I know there are privacy issues, but certainly would be better to solve them and come up with accurate numbers rather than basing such important decisions on people going out and saying to the neighbor next door, hey, do you know who lives next door? How many kids do they have? How old are they? It's just a model based on a time that is long gone. We don't know our neighbors. It's not efficient. And I understand those are only the people who didn't respond to the online forms, but that was like 40% of the country. 40%. We were relying on these alternative methods to get information out of them. It's too much. There's just too much inaccuracy.
Alan?
Well, you're right, Rosemary. There's too much inaccuracy, but the real question is whether the country has an appetite or the government for eschewing the results, right? I mean, think about that for a second. There's right, and then there's the question of, will this put such a kink in the way we do business in this country that people don't want to make that change?
Right.
Great point.
Right.
And because there was so much of a reliance on the online counting, I mean, that's what was really concerning to me, because those who are typically undercounted would be even more so, you know, in terms of being left out. And that's why we worked to have, we had outside events in front of grocery stores and other places to try to reach those who might not on their own go online and fill out the census. But still, you got to believe that there was a pretty significant, presume there's a pretty significant undercount.
And of course, I'm looking forward to the time, Teresa, that this whole thing, one way or the other, or t'other, as we say, gets to the Supreme Court of the United States with its 6-3 basically Republican majority.
But the I'm always amused at the people who claim to support the Constitution and the literal meaning of the Constitution, but then play games with things like the census. The Constitution specifically says we shall count persons, not citizens. Mm. Let's see what those six very conservative members of the Supreme Court would have to say.
No, go ahead, please.
I was going to say that it's very tricky, because the Constitution also says enumerate, which does not mean go into a database. It means go out and count them one by one. So they stuck to that, and yet they had no trouble apparently switching persons to citizens.
Mm. And as we've talked about, and Eric Holder has really been the champion on this issue. You know, one stage of this is, are people properly counted? And then the next stage is what the states do with the data and in terms of map drawing and policy making. And that's really the next thing to focus on is how they draw the districts and what implications will that have, particularly for the marginalized.
Well, to put it mildly, it doesn't look good for the Democrats.
Right.
Let's go to some more letters. We have quite a few. We'll get to as many as we can before the top of the hour. Mark writes, is all really lost in Florida to the Republicans? Some data indicates 1,000 people a month are moving to Florida. Do only Republicans move there? I know many Democrats that have moved or are planning on moving to Florida when they retire. There may be similar data for Texas and North Carolina. Won't this have an effect in the next 10 years as well? Thoughts? Asked Mark.
It's all so interesting. Think about this, folks. There were a lot of people who used to live in Brooklyn. Where did they go? They moved to, or Queens. They moved to Long Island. And when they got to Long Island, what did they do there? Many of them, but not all of them, many of them took on the political look of who was there. Because you wanted to get things done, there used to be the Alphonse D'Amato, you know, you had to have the right color card to get a job at a beach and that kind of thing. But that changed. So now you have a lot of Democrats winning office on Long Island. So the question I'm raising is, when you move from one place to the other, do you take on the political identity of the place you're moving to?
Anyone? All right.
Well, the other thing about undercounting is that these folks are still there. So if they undercount and they miscount and they do the maps based on the undercounting and the miscounting, but folks do a good job like they did in Georgia of registering the people who actually live in those communities,
yep,
there could be some political surprises. Now, you know, that's just looking for a rainbow there, but that's, you know, it's a possibility that because, you know, as Rosemary says, it appears that there probably is an undercount.
I think you're right. I think as people, we see that Texas, while it hasn't crossed over to the Democrats yet, it's getting closer.
Mm-hmm. I like that Teresa looks for rainbows.
I always look for the rainbow.
Elias writes, gerrymander is anti-democratic. 24 Republican majority states use it to maximum advantage. New York Democrats must fight back and use the gerrymander to negate the Republican advantage and actually increase our House of Representatives' Democratic numbers. That from Elias.
I just
to
have to
say
that I think that's a completely inaccurate view of how gerrymandering works. Both parties do it. And it's like what I said before, if you don't like what's being done, you call it one thing, and if you do like it, you call it something else. But if you know how it works from the inside, and I used to work in the legislature, both parties do it in a highly efficient way.
Absolutely correct. It's a bipartisan problem.
Although, think about this, folks. There came that point when there weren't enough Republicans to go around. You remember, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the most beautiful of all, whatever. And then Joe Bruno was the majority leader constitutionally because they would draw their own lines. But that changed, and now you got Democrats in both houses, and I suspect it's going to change again.
Let's go to Garrett, who says, I worked on the side of the census that most don't encounter. In 2019, they spread out to confirm and record all the habitable spaces in the country. Then we double check that work. Then the enumeration happened. Then we double check that, a sampling, not everyone. And there's another step coming up. I'm pretty confident that the system won't double count people if they completed more than one set of forms. And don't forget, this was the first time they relied heavily on online self-reporting. I encountered some people who thought they had done it already, but that often seemed like a way to avoid talking to me. Christine says, sorry for New York to lose a House seat, but Montana is grateful to pick up a second district. Our current at-large congressional district is the largest in the nation, population-wise, and second only to Alaska's in terms of geography. And maybe we can show the nation that Montana really is not made up of only crazy right-wing conspiracy theorists, anti-evolution, wolf-killing, anti-vaxxers like our governor. Now, I'm assuming Christine lives in Montana. I'm gonna go out on a limb on that and think that's the case.
I'm so excited to get a letter from Montana. That's
a real life Montana citizen. It's very nice. Tom writes, did you know that there are 10 Democratic senators who represent more people than all 50 of their Republican colleagues? I don't know what that means, quite frankly.
Well, I think that as the country population shifts around under the Constitution, the Senate representation does not. And you see these skews, just like that writer says.
This is a whole electoral college issue.
Right.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more items to discuss. Don't you worry. All kinds of stuff to discuss and talk about with our panel. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. I'm thinking about a lightning round when we come back. We'll do that in our final 50 minutes together. First, we have a break. News with Ray Graff, and we'll return. All right, let's get to it. A lot of topics in our on our docket, as I mentioned, so I want to get to as many as possible. So let's go. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Keep that in the back of your mind. So the Supreme Court has decided they will hear a gun control case next term on carrying weapons outside of the home. This comes from New York. The court will hear the challenge to a century-old New York law in the term that begins in October. The restriction requires that those who seek a permit to carry a concealed weapon to show a special need for self-defense, and is similar to laws in Maryland, Massachusetts, and elsewhere that the court in the past has declined to review. As the justices announced, they will consider this. Legal battle over gun control opened a new front. They will consider an important National Rifle Association-backed lawsuit asserting the constitutional right to carry a weapon outside of the home. Okay. Alan?
Ugh. UGH. This is not good. The fact that the court accepted it, and because the American people as a whole have been polled again and again in favor of more gun control. And I think the fact that the Supreme Court is taking it on is at least possible that they're going to make it easier for people to walk around in the Wild West and have their guns. It's awful.
Jim Ketterer.
Well, that they even accepted to take this case after not having taken one for over a decade is certainly a sign of the direction of the court with its new membership. And I guess it, for those who are wanting more gun control, not just in New York but across the country, to quote Alan, this is an ugh.
Rosemary?
Yeah, I had not realized this was a Rensselaer County case until I looked at the Times Union this morning. It's similar to New York's very old law from the early 1900s, mirrors laws that are in other states. So this is not just a Rensselaer County local case. It will have national impact. And I think there's very little reason to hope for a verdict other than 6-3 in favor of more open gun ownership, as if we need that. Ironically, the court is helping to spread a very good reason for people who could just obey the law. There is good reason to carry a gun now. We're seeing people buy guns who never wanted them before because it's getting extremely dangerous out there. You cannot go into schools or supermarkets or railroad stations or name the public space where you have to at least consider the possibility that you could be killed. This is a terrifying, absolutely terrifying development.
Teresa.
Yeah, I think the level of gun violence in our country is epidemic. It's a public health crisis, I believe, and it should be declared that and dealt with in that way. And I think that concealed carry, changing these laws, which I think I agree with everyone, that appears to be the direction this will go in. That's why they took the case, will only exacerbate that. And I'd be interested in talking with, you know, hearing from listeners who are responsible gun owners and, you know, why they think concealed carry is so important. Yes, guns for hunting, absolutely, you know, go have at it, do that safely. But having either concealed carry or open carry, I think just adds to the public health crisis that we're in right now all around the country with gun violence.
When it comes to this of looking at, I was just struck by what Rosemary and Alan were both saying, you know, of how, of UGG, and this is, you know, terrible. So, I mean, we sort of think of where the court's going to go on this. But with that said, do you think there will be an impact of what we're seeing? One of you mentioned the fact that, you know, polls tell us that the overwhelming number of people want to see some form of gun control. I believe that was you, Alan. Yeah. So do you think, I mean, obviously polls don't have an effect or shouldn't have an effect on the Supreme Court, but there is how the country feels about certain issues.
Well, let's try to remember that we have a reactionary Supreme Court. President Obama tried to put somebody on. He was refused through the chicanery of the Republican Senate and Mitch McConnell and all the rest of it. It isn't exactly that we have a bunch of impartial jurists sitting up there with black robes on who are going to interpret the law fairly. It's a very political process. It could be the third branch of way in which the Congress acts.
And it's not just the Supreme. I mean, in this case, you're absolutely right, Alan, the importance of the Supreme Court. But you've got to remember that one of the things the Trump administration was extremely successful at was to pack the courts at the lower levels. And so you're going to see the implications of that for decades. And certainly they selected judges who shared their views, and the support for the NRA is one of them. It'll be interesting, given all of the legal and financial issues with the NRA, what will their role be in all of this? And presumably this will help them with their much-needed fundraising efforts. But, you know, this is being done in the backdrop of all of the controversy with the NRA. So we'll see what implications that have. But this seems to be a fundraising bonanza for them, unfortunately.
You know, Joe, I think that a lot of the polls, or I suspect, are driven by these horrible mass shootings.
Right.
And as horrible as they are, it's actually a relatively small component of the overall gun problem in the United States. That, you know, a third, it's mostly handguns, and a third of it, you know, through criminal activity, and then domestic violence, and then suicide. And each of those are huge public health and public policy issues that require different sorts of fixes in terms of public policy. And the country is just absolutely awash in these guns already. And, you know, I think that the polling and the public attention is not really focused on those things. It's focused on what was on CNN in the last horrible case. And it's not that they're not horrible, but that's not the big component of the problem.
Absolutely. The domestic violence issue with guns and the suicide issue, that's, you know, a serious part of the public health crisis. And I don't have the data in front of me, but the increased numbers of people purchasing guns is astronomical. And, you know, if there's no or limited restriction on this, and if there's open carry and concealed carry, it's only going to make the situation worse.
Yeah, guns and ammunition, which I think we should also point out, because buying ammunition is almost impossible these days because people are stocking up.
And, you know, as I say, using guns for hunting is one thing, but using them for hunting people, we should just be doing everything to avoid that, prevent that, and that's not happening.
All right, let's go to...
Well, I think what's...
Go
I
ahead.
Think, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I just want to say that I think that's what's really needed is that we get this issue, just as we get women's reproductive rights, out of the courts. It's never going to change. We're getting worse when you look at just judicial decisions. What we need is, and I hope Biden can provide this in leadership and writing laws that will stand up to Supreme Court death and will also protect people. We have not had that for a while.
But how do we slow the just incredibly rapid purchase of weapons in this of guns in this country? I mean, that cannot be legislated. There's a problem in this country where people arming up at alarming rates, and that cannot
lost,
be legislated.
Hmm?
What'd you say, Rosemary?
That battle, I fear, is lost. I think that battle is lost already. The numbers have been going up since Obama went in. And Trump played up the idea that Democrats were coming after your guns, so people were buying weapons then. And if you are a minority right now and you're reading all this stuff about cops, would you not want to be armed? We have gotten nothing for the last at least 10 years but reasons to arm ourselves, self-defense, mass killings.
The solution to that is
really lost.
But the solution to that is not arming yourselves, it's de-arming the country. I mean, I saw a really disturbing but profound video the other day about a underage person. I can't remember how old he was, but they went in and tested this. He couldn't buy a lottery ticket. He couldn't buy beer. He couldn't buy cigarettes, but the kid was able to buy a gun, and without much trouble. I mean, that's a problem in this country.
Yes.
It is, but it isn't recognized by the people who have made it a problem. You can say that to us and in this audience, and we all applaud you, but try that in Texas. What kind of a response are you going to get to that in Wyoming? What are you going to get as a response in any of those states that are now also increasing in power, as we just spent the first 20 minutes discussing?
But what do you do about what Jim was talking about? What do you do about the domestic violence and gun intersection? What do you do about the suicides, which are just an incredible pace? And how do you deal with that as a public health crisis? Why can't you deal with that as a public health crisis in association with guns? That's not the, you know, going out and hunting on the weekend.
Lisa, we can't even deal with the public health crisis as a public health crisis. Take on guns? Who's going to do that? The CDC, the FDA? Come on.
All right. Go ahead.
That's what needs to happen.
All right. We'll pause there on that subject and move on to others and my quest to try to get everything in today. I don't know why I'm engaged in such a quest, but it just seems fun, so we'll do it.
The hamburger one, we got to get to that.
I will. It's a fascinating story.
I was kidding.
No, I find it to be fascinating. Anyway, Jim, you brought this up earlier in regards to the horrible situation that is happening in India in regards to coronavirus and the numbers that are just out of control in India. Now we learn that as the virus rages abroad, President Biden is promising to ship millions of vaccine doses, 60 million doses of AstraZeneca's vaccine to countries pleading for help. But some see a medicine dropper for a, quote, four-alarm fire, is how this is being described. The announcement came after Mr. Biden spoke with the Prime Minister of India, and the two pledged to work closely together in the fight against COVID-19. It is a significant, albeit limited, shift for the White House, which has until now been reluctant to make excess doses of coronavirus vaccine available in large amounts. Alan Chartok.
Well, we're certainly doing the right thing. It may be, as was pointed out on yesterday's panel, belated, but we are certainly doing the right thing for a lot of reasons. One of them is to show the rest of the world that we can be cooperative and we can try to get along and try to help those people who need the help. And so it's the right thing to do, and I think Biden gets credit for it, is my favorite word, in contradistinction to the last guy.
Yeah. Jim.
Yeah, I mean, there's a hot and heavy contest going on of vaccine diplomacy. And at least in the parts of the world that I have been in recently and I'm familiar with, the U.S. is far behind the Chinese and the Russians. And Egypt, as an example, a country of 110 million people, there's no Pfizer, there's no Moderna. And now the idea that to India and maybe to other places we would send a vaccine that we haven't approved in our own country and may in, to some degree be coming from a manufacturing facility that had contaminated some of the vaccines. This kind of undermines the whole diplomatic initiative of this. In addition, you know, maybe public health is one thing, the diplomacy and the optics of that are another. It will be interesting to see how the U.S. jumps into this game beyond India. Will we look at public health only first and perhaps only, or will we really start to pick and choose who we're going to send vaccines to, what kind of vaccines, how much, based upon our relations with that country and our view of those governments? As I said, the Chinese are very active at it, as are the Russians, and we're way behind.
Rosemary.
It's interesting. I've been reading about Lend-Lease in World War II, and the Russians wanted a, you know, you give us this and we'll give you that, kind of a business transaction. And for Roosevelt, it was always give them whatever they want because they're fighting. They're putting men in the fight against Germans that we won't have to. It was worth it. And that's exactly the point of view that we should have about vaccines right now. Every shot that we give overseas protects Americans. And we've not done a very good job, as we have not in anything in the public relations battle over COVID, to explain that, but it's true. And as for sending AstraZeneca, Americans aren't going to take it. There's just been too much bad publicity. That's not a problem in Europe. It's not a problem in South America. So I think it's a great use of it. And I hope we will go on and start spreading Moderna and Pfizer and whatever other vaccines come out. Cuba, by the way, has promised, has a huge medical structure, and it is promised that it is working on, I think they have 5 vaccine candidates right now, and when they get one that's certified, they're going to spread it in South America. It's not just a humanitarian action, although that's true, it does help. It's just self-preservation. Why would you not do it? Trump never got that. I think Biden does get it.
I want to get, we were mentioning AstraZeneca, and just the thought real quick on the EU suing AstraZeneca over missing vaccine doses. The EU has sued AstraZeneca over what the bloc has described as delays in shipping hundreds of millions of doses of coronavirus vaccines, a sharp escalation of a longstanding dispute between the bloc and the maker of one of the world's most important vaccines. AstraZeneca has said it would be able to deliver only a third of the 300 million doses that European officials had been expecting by the end of June. As a result, the EU said on Monday that they believed AstraZeneca had broken its contract and that they were seeking speedier deliveries than the company said it could muster. I hearken back to what you just said a moment ago, Jim Ketterer, about vaccine diplomacy. So how does this fit in?
Well, it's, you know, I think it all is dependent on capacity, but, you know, the optics really do matter. You know, I agree with what Rosemary was saying, that AstraZeneca can be acceptable on many other levels. But if it's coming from the U.S. and we have said it's not acceptable to us, but we'll give it to you, and we'll give it to you from a place that may have some cloud hanging over it, that is problematic in just the way that people see it. I mean, people are not just in the U.S., people in other parts of the world, many of them are very skeptical of taking the vaccine, and if you send it in a way that makes them even more skeptical, that's a problem. Also, you know, there's just capacity. These vaccines that require 2 doses and require, you know, very intensive low temperature refrigeration is much more difficult than, say, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So, you know, all these come into play when you get into the complications of working around the world, in addition to the complications of just the diplomacy and the international politics of it.
Rosemary?
Yeah, I'm not saying it's ideal. Don't get me wrong. But in the face of COVID, which is such a horrible disease, a lot of this stuff dissolves. Serbia in March had too many AstraZeneca doses. They could not get it out to their own people fast enough. So they opened it up, and they were overwhelmed by people coming in from Bosnia and the rest of the Balkans to get AstraZeneca. And they were not saying, oh, this isn't the best one to get. We have an embarrassment of riches in the U.S.
Teresa.
Yeah, I think that I just echo what everyone else says. I think that the virus knows no boundaries, and we, for both humanitarian and diplomatic reasons, need to do everything possible. And I don't begin to understand supply chain issues, but when I read that the U.S. is, you know, blocking some of the components of these from being exported, therefore making it harder for India to even produce its own, you know, there may be reasons for that. It seems disturbing if that's the case, and hopefully those kinds of problems are getting fixed. But I think that globally, we should do everything possible to get as much vaccine to as many people in a way that they can actually administer it. As Jim said, it's not just getting it to people; it's getting it to countries in a way that they can actually get shots in arms.
Alan?
Well, you know, I'm sort of caught on this one. I'm hearing what Jim said. On the other hand, you know, I don't think that the vaccine literacy is as great as he may imply. In other words, that people can distinguish between them and know them. I was talking to a guy this morning who walked in and he got the J&J vaccine. And he didn't have any choice in it. He was just sort of getting it. I think the choice is, what is it? How many people are dead in the United States? 572,000, something like that? That's a lot of people. And I think a lot of people want to survive and will do what they have to do. So I'm less to I'm less likely to buy in on Dean Ketterer's analysis that people will reject the AstraZeneca because, as we have said, very popular in Europe.
Yeah, I don't think they'll reject it, Alan. But I do think. Yeah. I mean, I've heard multiple. Friends of mine in Egypt say, you know, I mean, in terms of vaccine literacy, they're not so thrilled with effectiveness of the Chinese one. They don't know about the Russian one. They do know a lot more about what's available in the U.S. Because the rest of the world knows a lot more about us than we know about them. And they're basically saying, where are the Americans? I thought you were our friends. Where are they? Why is it that we're left with these choices of Chinese and Russian? And there is now AstraZeneca available there. But, you know, so I think people are paying close attention to not only what's available, but where it's coming from and who's helping and who's not.
And, Jim, from your experience, can the U.S. help be not just in getting the vaccine, but helping with them with logistics and processes for how to get shots in arms?
Yeah, you know, this is going to be a real test now for the new Biden team. We have Samantha Power, former UN ambassador, who is the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development. We have the new Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, and then the U.S. military, which is fantastic at logistics. So to kind of bring those three pieces together of the national security team and to do this right for all the reasons that we've been talking about, this is really a test. And so that's a way of punting your question and saying that there's a lot that we'd have to get right. But I do think we have more capacity than any other country in the world to do something like this.
Because clearly the Biden administration demonstrated that they had ability to very quickly right the ship in terms of how to do the vaccine distribution, right? You know, there was a vaccine, but no process in place to get it distributed. And by no means was it perfect, a lot of bumps in the road, but learned a lot, know the logistics, know the process. And to the extent that that could be shared in other places, I think would be as important as the vaccine itself.
Yeah, I completely
agree.
There's
one other thing to consider too. There's one other thing to consider, and that is that none of this has to be bilateral. There is the World Health Organization. There are organizations that are working together for global vaccines, and the United States under Biden has rejoined those operations. And that would be a way to spread technical knowledge as well as supplies and all the other things that you're talking about. By region, by countries, by cooperation, not just the U.S. giving stuff to other people.
Right, but engage through the COVAX system. But I think that's what the U.S. is doing, right?
Right.
Aren't they engaging through COVAX?
Correct. Mm-hmm. They are.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a few more stories to get to. We will do so in our last segment with our panelists this morning, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Jim Ketterer. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have a wonderful panel indeed. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Jim Ketterer back with us. And we are thrilled to have him back and thrilled to have you with us. Panel at WAMC.org is our is where you can email us, and we would love to hear what you have to say. A couple topics I would like to get to in our remaining 15, 20 minutes or so. We go to this story, which I will preface by saying I have a weird connection to, I will facilitate the conversation, but will not do any more than that just to recuse myself from the discussion. But the family of a North Carolina man killed by deputies is shown a 20-second video. This is the case out of Elizabeth City, North Carolina, where the family of Andrew Brown Jr. watched a snippet of his final moments, but that hasn't stopped the demands for publicly releasing body camera footage of the fatal shooting. Despite appeals from the governor and other elected leaders, community activists, and the family of a man who was killed by sheriff's deputies, the authorities in a North Carolina coastal county have not publicly released body camera footage of the deadly encounter as of Monday evening. So basically what is happening here is it was the day after the Derek Chauvin verdict was read. This incident happened in North Carolina, and ever since then, the family has been looking for the release of the body cam footage, which has not been released except for this 20-second snippet, and only to them. So, who would like to start? Alan, do you want to start?
Well, I'm all in favor of the more transparency, the better. If they think something can come out from releasing this, and if the family does, I don't see why not. There may be reasons. There may be police who think that their lives or their reputations may be online. But as we have seen, you really can't get around that demand.
Rosemary.
Well, I don't think this is anything new. We're seeing now what has been going on with the police unchecked for years, and I think the black community has known this. They've tried to tell us. Now we're listening because we're seeing it, and that's exactly what the police chief there, I think, is trying to stop. He does not want us to see this. I can't imagine. He said his reason, as I understood it, was that there's an internal investigation going on, and so he couldn't show what happened on a public street. I mean, let's think about that. This is private, even though it happened in public, the murder of a citizen. I'm sorry, even if he's guilty of the crime that he's accused of on a drug warrant, it's not a capital offense. He was executed on a public street. And
we just lost Rosemary, I think. Rosemary?
We didn't do it. I swear we didn't.
Just
do
lost
it.
Me. I'm back.
Oh, there
I'm
you
back.
Go. Okay, go.
Yeah, No, it was me. The fact that this happens to three Americans a day is just coming home to the larger community, and it is appalling. And I want police reform. I'm in favor of bad wording, but the defunding movement to reorganize resources so that we handle cases. Why are armed police, armed with tasers and guns, enforcing minor traffic violations, for example? Why are they responding to mental health cases? I think that makes a lot of sense. And the more these come out, the more these cases come out, the more I'm thinking that I'm not being persuaded that we need more money on police and all the counter arguments. It's disgusting.
Teresa, let me ask you, in your former life you still do it, but as far as communications specialist, if everyone's going to be talking about it and the press is going to be at your doorstep and you keep on telling them, we're not going to show you, what is the point to that? Unless it's really bad. And then if it's really bad, don't you want to get out in front of it?
Well, in this case, I don't know the answer to that because I don't know what's on the tape. And sometimes I do believe that there is a process issue here that's very important, which is before a tape should be released, there should be a system in place for it to be reviewed. And I think that's as much for the protection of the victims or any innocent bystanders, often in case kids or whatever, because remember, most of the cases with body camera footage is not this, right? And so I do think that there should be some review process. And in this case, there is. They need to go to a judge. Why did it take them a week? They didn't go to the judge until yesterday. So I don't know why they waited all these days to go to the judge and ask to have the footage released. But I do think that if there aren't extensive extenuating circumstances, they should go to the judge and get it out as fast as possible, because in case after case after case, they've seen that eventually it comes out, and it's, you know, the delay only exacerbates the problem. But I don't think that there should be a change in the process, that they need to keep a review process in this as a step in the process of getting these kinds of things out.
Meanwhile, I just blanked on the term. A state of emergency was declared in Elizabeth City for the city, although the protests over the last several days have been peaceful and large, but peaceful.
And that is concerning to me. And you know, I don't know why they declared a state of emergency, but we do have to get at this issue of why, you know, these folks have been very, very peaceful, and why there's this drumbeat to suggest that it's not going to be otherwise, I think is persistent and problematic. And so, in any case.
Jim.
Yeah, I agree with everything that everyone has just said. You know, the longer you wait, the worse it's going to be. It is important to have a process, but it seems like they're clearly trying to slow roll this, and it's just not going to get better. The incident itself is terrible, but they're trying to cover it up or trying to hope that people will have their attention directed somewhere else. If you wait too long or long enough, that's really just not going to work. And I can look at many examples across the country that have happened before where it doesn't work. Yet here we are with another locality trying the same thing.
And I just, again, I can't get over the communications issue of that the longer you wait, just the worse it gets. And I don't know why you wouldn't want to avoid that, which I can't quite understand. And I also can't understand why every police force in the entire country, just before the officers go out, say, please don't shoot anybody today. I don't know. Does that not make
sense?
Because
maybe we're just simply underplaying the rampant racism in our police departments. I know that's radical. We keep emphasizing, oh, most of them are good and it's really not so bad, but it's looking pretty bad. And really, it hasn't increased or decreased, but it's stayed the same over the last, I think, decade. 3 people a day.
Right.
Are killed by police officers. More are hurt, maimed with this. Why do our police shoot to kill when it's not a life or death situation? Why? Now is the time to begin asking and finding new solutions to these thoughts that used to be radical, that to be safe, we have to give all power and love to police. I don't think that way anymore.
Well, I spent 3 years in Boston working with the police in our anti-violence programs, and I do think that they, you know, the vast majority of them do a very good job under extremely difficult circumstances, and just like in any other profession, there are some who shouldn't be in that profession, and you see that played out over and over again in these headlines. But I think that we cannot say that because some of them shouldn't be police officers, it shouldn't taint the work of all of them, because they are the last line of defense, not last line of defense. I don't mean that at all. They are the people who have to deal with the fact that we have no comprehensive mental health system in this country to deal with people or homelessness or domestic violence or a whole host of other things. And they are asked to do what so many other people, you know, are not doing or will not do. And it's very complicated. And I believe that I will not defend the behavior of the Chauvins by any case. But I will say that the vast majority of police officers have a very difficult job and do it to the best of their ability. Will they make mistakes? Yes. Some of them shouldn't be officers? Yes. But that's not the vast majority of them.
I think that that's all lovely, but it denies that there's a systemic problem that has to be faced. And for every Chauvin, it's easy to say, I don't agree with Chauvin. You know, even Trump didn't agree with Chauvin because he was an extreme case. But think about that that Virginia trooper who stopped a young man who bravely filmed the whole thing, and he was saying, you're going to get your butt whopped and all that stuff. And how come his fellow officers didn't come out and criticize him? How come when there are disciplined for dozens of cases, and Chauvin was one of them, we don't hear about it, that nothing gets done, that it's excused? It's not enough to say most of them are good. There is a systemic problem in the United States with policing.
Well, I think we have an enabling problem in a lot of different situations, and that's an enabling problem. But I also think we need to diversify with women and minorities our police forces, and what's the effort underway to do that? We need more and more training. We need more community engagement. These are deep problems that need to be fixed, but it's not an easy fix.
We have letters, one on this and then a lot on gun control, so I'll try to get to as many of those before we wrap up this morning. George writes, in North Carolina, where I live, you must get a judge to release body cam footage. I understand that. My question, though, is, first of all, why does it take so long for the judge to, that Lisa was, or Teresa was saying this a moment ago, why can't that happen sooner?
They didn't go to the judge till yesterday.
Yeah.
That's the question. Why didn't they go to the judge right away? Why did they wait till yesterday to go to the judge?
Because we're honing in on a week now.
Right.
So John writes to us, and let's see. So we have people from Montana, North Carolina, all over the place writing us this morning. John writes, I own a handgun. I belong to a gun club and use it for target practice. I find that it's a really useful skill to improve focus and hobby that is really fun. I enjoy the sport and most of the people I have met through it. While I'm all for mandatory background investigations, which, by the way, took me 8 months to get and I can't carry in public, which I'm okay with, I feel that further tightening of handgun laws misses the target. No pun intended, I'm sure.
He can't carry in public. That's the key.
All right, I'm just going to read the rest of the letter and then jump away. We should be worrying more about militarized weapons. It's my opinion that it's not only the gun, but the mindset of the person who buys this type of weapon that we should focus on. Regulating because of the possibility of suicide feels way too Orwellian to me and shouldn't be part of the equation. Thank you for listening and the great programming. Go ahead, Teresa.
Thank you for writing, and you made my point. You are a responsible gun owner who accepts the fact that you can't conceal carry in public.
Hmm. Anybody else on that?
And you're okay with that.
David writes, we don't arm meter maids. Why do traffic cops need to be armed? Write a ticket or not. No one needs to die. All right. We go to this one from Matthew. If everyone is allowed to open or conceal carry guns, what will happen with police always seeing a gun in someone's hand and then killing them? This gives the police an out, and the community at large will bear the brunt once again. Joe writes,
so many police officers are opposed to having too many guns around, and police chiefs regularly go on record as being for gun control. I think it's important to remember that.
And I don't know if it's because they want an out. It's just because it makes it much more, their situation much more complicated.
Joe writes, if the court expands the right to concealed carry or open carry, I think that we must insist that people coming into the Supreme Court building be permitted the same rights. That may make the justices think twice. Erica says, citizen vigilantes, is this how we are going to reform the police? We don't need them, right? Having a gun is like having a child. Not everyone is all that great at it. I like that point. Nick's
great letters in a row.
Nick writes, the two most important words in the Second Amendment are well regulated. Also, George says, why is there an assumption by the panel that any decision by the court will entail less gun control? Could it be that a 100-plus-year-old New York State law could be reinterpreted by the court to fashion a modern approach? Alan?
No.
I think Jim pointed that out, right, Jim? As they called the case that they hadn't called for a decade. Jim answered
that. Right, there's a reason behind this, that they called for it.
That was a maniacal laugh, Rosemary.
That 6-3 majority is sure going to shift back in favor of gun control. Come on.
Right. Right after that, they're going to open up abortion and contraception. Sure.
All right. We are done. I want to thank everybody for being with us and for a lively discussion. I am sorry, Teresa, we didn't get to the burger story. That's the only
Where's
thing
the
we
beef?
Missed out on. Yeah. Where's the beef? We will talk more, of course, tomorrow, and we welcome you to be with us for that. My thanks, of course, to Alan Chartok. Thank you, Alan. Also,
thank you, Joe.
Thanks to Rosemary, Teresa, and Jim. Jim, good to have you back. We'll talk to you soon. We will return right after this.